Welcome to the Real Estate Investing Club. This is the place everyday real estate investors gather to share their best stories, biggest insights, and favorite tactics to grow a portfolio of cash flowing properties in today's market. Here's your host, Gabe Peterson.
All right. Happy Friday again, everybody. I know I say this every time, but we do all our episodes on Fridays. So it is always a beautiful Friday here. And I hope I'm bringing this Friday energy to you guys wherever you are, whatever day you're listening to this. Hope you're having a good day. And today is going to be a good episode because we got Matt Burke with us on the podcast from Lake Oswego, Oregon. Another PNW guy here. We love having us on the podcast. Matt is from Fairway America and Verivest. He has done 11 Reg D funds. We don't often have the fund guys on here. Often we talk about syndications. We don't go into the fund model. So this will be an interesting podcast. Matt, thanks for hopping on the show.
Thanks for having me, Gabe. I appreciate it.
All right. I told you before we got on here, we like starting with stories. So I'm sure you've been in the game for a long time. Let's go all the way back to the beginning when you first got into real estate and tell me the story. How'd you get in? And I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, well, in the early days, I went to work for a California-based thrift and loan. And we were doing, back in the early 90s, we were doing hard money loans on commercial real estate. So kind of got cut my teeth in the finance business, making loans on things that traditional lenders wouldn't lend on, a lot of commercial stuff, kind of funky, weird things that couldn't get done in a bank. And kind of that's how I cut my teeth. That company, I moved up to Portland, actually, from California, start a branch office for them. And they got caught up in the S&L crisis of the early 90s. And offered me a job to come back, but I already moved. So I said, well, hey, so I hung out my own shingle and started Fairway in 1992 and kind of been a journey ever since. But really started out, Gabe, in the finance side of the real estate business.
Awesome. So you've been through many ups, many downs in the 90s, 2008. I'm sure you have a lot of stories that go into that period. It sounds like you run your own funds. So you have your own funds that you have started. And do you source the deals? Are you the GP on the deals? Are you just raising capital? How do you fit into the deals that you run?
Yeah, you know, we have a pretty unique business model that's morphed over the years, Gabe. And I'd say we do a little bit of all of the above. We're not really a direct sponsor. We're more on the capital side. Mm. I would say that coming out of the Great Recession in 2009-10 range, we started doing advisory work. So I had people asking me about, you mentioned funds here at the outset, right? We've run a bunch of 506 Reg D funds. I'd say at this point, after all these years, I'm as much of an expert as anybody I know in that space. But we helped people set up their own funds. So we've played the lead advisory role over the last 12 years to set up probably 250 plus funds around the country. And those relationships that we create through that advisory business is really where we get our lead flow for our funds, right? So we partner up, we'll take some GP stakes, we'll do some LP deals, we'll make some loans. It's a variety of different things, but a lot of it comes from the relationships we have with people around the country that we have helped to set up their own pooled investment fund.
Cool. So let's talk about the difference, the pros and cons of the fund model versus the syndication model.
Yeah.
And for all you guys listening out there, if you want to get into bigger deals, you know, maybe you've done a few flips, maybe you bought your first commercial with your own capital, you want to get into bigger things, you have to raise money for it. You're either going to go with a fund model or you're going to go with the syndication model. And there's pros and cons to each of them. So tell us, what are the pros and cons and why did you choose funds over syndications?
Yeah, and we've done both, you know, quite a bit of both. And so, you know, over the years, there's, you know, we've gravitated toward funds. There, as you said, man, there's pros and cons. I like to simplify it as much as possible, Gabe, in a, you know, short period of time. Basically, in a fund, you have more diversity, right? Because the people are investing in a pooled fund that owns multiple assets. So you're not as exposed to any one individual asset. You know, but the trade-off of that is that from an investor standpoint, you don't get to pick and choose which assets go in the fund, right? It's discretionary on the part of the manager. So you're abdicating more control over the decision-making. So, you know, again, it's a trade-off. But I think that fundamentally, a fund from a manager perspective, if you can raise money in it, it gives you more control, more discretion, more ability to move quickly, et cetera. But that's a big if you can raise money in it, because the bar is just much higher from an investor standpoint to invest in a pooled fund than an individual deal. So there are a lot of other things besides those, but I'd say those are the biggest.
Yeah, and I've never opened a fund myself. I don't know too much about them, but that does seem like the biggest benefit. You know, I've gone down the syndication route, and the problem is you open a syndication when you have the deal in front of you, and so you're kind of on a timeline. Like, you need to
Time
raise
pressure.
money, and the problem that I've found is that even if you, I've spoken with people before who have money they want to invest,
Yeah.
it doesn't mean that they're going to have money the moment that you're doing the
That's
deal.
right.
And so you run into this problem where you've already communicated with these people, but you find a deal and all of a sudden they say, "Hey, I just invested that in, you know, I'm out of money that I can invest, and so I can't invest in your deal." So you're
Yeah.
shit out of luck. But the fund
Yeah,
model has
or
plenty.
they're traveling, they're overseas, you can't track them down, right? And the meanwhile, the clock is ticking, and you've put hard earnest money up, you've got X number of days to close, you're not sure if you can get there. I mean, the pressure is immense, right, on a syndicated model. But on the other hand, like, it forces investors to make a decision, right? Because they have a time frame. Well, that's a downside of a fund, Gabe, is like there is no real time pressure. Right. The fund is, I mean, in a closed-ended fund, there is toward the end of the raise period, but in an open-ended fund, it's kind of like I can invest today, I can invest tomorrow. There's no time pressure. So there's all these, trade-offs at every level in the difference between running a fund and a syndication. And, pick your poison, right? Now, there is no panacea. There's nothing that's perfect. They each have their own strengths and weaknesses and pressure points.
And I mean, I didn't even think about that from, you know, as the capital raiser, when I approach somebody to invest in a fund, they don't have a timeline. I mean, there's no sense of urgency for them. They're not going to be like, "Oh shit, I got to make this decision today." They'll be
Yeah.
like, "Okay, great. I'll think about this," and months will pass, and there's no reason for them to make the decision unless they have something in front of them.
Yeah, and you can do some things to alleviate or ameliorate that concern, right? You can create multiple classes of shares. You can create kind of a first batch of people that get a slightly better deal if they do it within the first $5 million or a first time period. I mean, so there are things that you can try to do. Like, sometimes they're effective, sometimes they're not. But again, you're right. There's not nearly as much in a syndication. It's kind of like you call the guy, the investor up and say, "Hey, I need to close by this date. I've got this much money to raise. Are you in? Are you out?" Right? And at least they say yes or no, and you move on to the next one. In a fund, you're constantly working the same, or your investor base and talking to them about it and so forth. And what a lot of them will do is dip their toe in the water, put a little bit in at the beginning, see how it goes, and then they'll add to it. So you definitely get that factor. So,
Is the minimum investment in funds generally lower than in, you know, 50,000 is kind of the standard for syndications. Is it lower than the syndication model, or is it about the same?
it's about the same. It varies. I mean, I've seen them as low as, 10 or 25,000 on the very low end. I mean, I'd say 50 is probably 50 and 100 are the two most common numbers, especially in what I call small balance. Sub-institutional funds, let's say funds below $100 million. But I've seen funds as well that are, a lot of people will do it at 250 or 500 or even a million, which of course a lot fewer investors, are going to stroke a seven-figure check than a five-figure check. So it varies. So it's really at the choice of the manager.
And so when you're approaching these investors, I'm just thinking, if I put my hat on as an investor, what I would be concerned about is like, okay, I'm going to give you this money. How long is it going to sit there? Like, do you guarantee an investment within a certain time frame, or are they just
No.
giving writing a ch check to you in the hopes that you will in the next 6 months close a deal?
Yeah, cardinal rule is, as you well know in investing, right? You never guarantee anything, because there are no guarantees in life and investing, right? So you never guarantee anything. I mean, you can make your best estimates, and you can say what you're attempting to do and what you're trying to do and what you believe will happen. But at the end of the day, there is no guarantee on exactly how long it will take. I mean, in your offering documents, you need to articulate what is your strategy, what type of investments are you making or not making, what is the expected time period. All that's written out in the documents. But then, of course, the lawyers will have you, write the whole risk factors and everything else, saying, "Hey, based on everything we've said, we're going to try that. But, you know, caveat.
Yeah. So you've gone through this 11 times. Each fund generally has a specific asset that they're investing into, correct?
A specific type of assets. Yeah. They're so, you know, and again, that's up to the manager as to how broad or narrow they want to make the fund mandate. I mean, you can make it from a legal standpoint, you can make it as, and I'm not a lawyer, so let me always caveat by saying this is not legal advice, but I've done this enough, you know, to know the answer, right? Which is that as a manager, you can make that mandate as broad or narrow as you like. It really comes down to what will investors invest in. Right. If it's super broad and you can do anything under the sun, that's a harder sale. And you need to have a, you know, more experience and have done it before and so forth to kind of be able to give yourself that much flexibility. Most of them, Gabe, would have a more narrow mandate. Hey, we're going to make first trustee mortgage loans in the Pacific Northwest, you know, or we're going to do value add multifamily class B and C in, you know, the Southeast or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, I mean, you've gone through this 11 times. I'm sure you've picked up some pretty good lessons learned over the, the course of these 11 funds.
Oh, yeah.
If you were to go back to the you who had maybe done like three or four or whatever, however many syndications, and then you were thinking about doing your first fund, what are the lessons that you know now that you wish that earlier version of Matt had known?
Well, one, keep it simple. Don't try to be everything to everybody, right? It, the simpler, the better. You know, understand, and especially on the first fund, I'd say keep it tight, keep it narrow, keep it to what you know. And you don't need to make it, especially if your deal sizes aren't gigantic, keep it relatively small, prove that you can do it, and get through that first one and execute. Right. And then once you do that, you can do a second and a third and you can, you know, do more and then you can get a little bit more elaborate or expand a little bit and so forth. I think, you know, one of the mistakes I made and I see we have still to this day an advisory practice that helps people set up their own fund. And we've done, you know, I don't know the exact count, Gabe, 250, 300, somewhere in that range. So I've seen the mistakes that people make. And I would say, you know, in the beginning, you want to keep it simple. You want to make sure that your structure is one that will be appealing to investors and that can be administered properly. A lot of people, and this would be included when I did the first one, had no idea really how to do pooled fund accounting, right? Because that's a whole area of expertise that the typical real estate syndicator does not possess. You know, so I created a set of documents that I couldn't even administer. I spent, you know, 50, 80 grand, whatever it was on those documents. And then I launched and I couldn't even do what I said I could do in the documents because the lawyer wasn't on the same page as the accountant or the software. So I had to redo all the documents and spend another 20 grand, you know, so things like that happen. And it happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Right. So I try to bring the lessons learned to our clients so that they don't make the same mistakes that I made.
Yep, exactly. And that's why you get a mentor. That's why you get an advisor for any new venture that you get into, because it sucks to have to learn those lessons on your own.
Yeah, it's got OPE, right? Other people's experience, right? The more you can learn from OPE, the better.
Yep, there you go. So what is the ideal size of the first fund? If you were to launch a first fund, is it like 1 million, 2 million, 10 million? What is the ideal size for your first fund?
It depends on what kind of assets. Like, so for example, if somebody's buying houses and the average equity, you know, you're put 60-70% leverage and your average equity checks, you know, 80 or 100 grand, I mean, you can get by with a pretty small fund, you know, 5 million, 10 million. If you're buying retail buildings and your average deal size is, you know, 25 million and your average equity check is 8 or 10, right, then you need something considerably bigger. So it really depends on what kind of assets you're doing. I would also say that there are some fixed costs associated with running a fund that when the fund is tiny, those fund costs will chew up the net income of that fund pretty quickly. So you have to be careful that you have at least a minimum threshold of size so that the fund expenses don't eat up all the net income. Even if you're producing good returns at the asset level, the fund level expenses can cause the returns to be too low. So you need a minimum threshold, and I'd say even for very small average deal sizes, probably 5 or 10 million is, if you can't get it to that, probably doesn't make much sense.
5 to 10 million, that makes sense. And below that, obviously there's syndications, which is
Just do one deal at a time, or syndicate, do one deal at a time, match them up, one investor, one deal, one trustee, or fractionalize them, right, and bring in multiple investors on an asset by asset basis.
Cool. So let's talk about your own investing. What type of assets are you into these days? Is there anything that you kind of gravitate towards? What are you aimed at today?
Yeah, I mean, it's varied. I mean, I think we're opportunistic and look for things that make sense. I mean, we've done a lot of multifamily the last few years. I like debt. I've always came from the finance side, so I think debt is good. Obviously, you don't have the same upside on debt as you do on equity, but you also don't have the same risk and downside that if something goes sideways, right? Equity is the first to go. So, we'll look at anything though. I think if people are, we look really at the people. I mean, who are the folks that are doing the deals? Do they know what they're doing? Are they authentic? Are they honest? Are they competent, capable? That's what we generally look at first. And then after that, as long as it makes sense, I think we'll shy away from, sort of outlier asset types that we don't understand. So a lot of it we've done over the years has been multifamily. We've done quite a bit of retail and done pretty well with that. We have not done much office, thankfully. That asset class is, tough. We've done quite a bit of storage and that has worked out pretty well. And we've done quite a bit of debt and quite a bit of industrial as well.
No, oh, okay. It's pretty much everything. Didn't hear mobile home RV. That's what we do.
I would actually like to do more of that. We have not encountered as much on the sponsor side as we'd like. So that we should have a conversation. But yes, we've done a little bit here and there, dabbled, I'd say, but not a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like pretty much everything, which is good. Office obviously is a tough one these days, but hopefully there'll be a new use for those office buildings. Actually, on a tangent, I read an article earlier today about converting office buildings in New York City to multifamily, essentially. And the engineering behind that conversion, due to the regulations and the permits and all the things that have to happen in this article, they basically had to take the center of the building out in order to meet some kind of ratio that they needed to meet. And it was just crazy. It was a tangent, but it's really interesting what you can do to real estate. If it's been built, it's an office building, it can be something else. And there's so many options. You just got to solve the problems.
Yeah. And there's a lot of moving parts to that kind of stuff, right? We have also done a number of hotel conversions into multifamily, and I love that strategy. I'd say the execution of it is very difficult, particularly in this market with, the elevated interest rates and the capital market kind of meltdown. But, I think your main point is, I think you're seeing lots of repurposing of former uses in retail, in office, in hotel, and other types of property as the secular changes and post-COVID and, the development of tech and AI. I mean, it's really changing real estate in interesting ways that present a lot of opportunity, a lot of risk, but it'll be interesting to see in the next 10, 20 years how that plays out.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. All right, I just took a peek at the clock. It looks like we have run down our 15 minutes, so it's time to jump into the quick question round. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, starts with books or any form of education, could be movies, could be documentaries, YouTube channels, whatever. Just give me two recommendations, one for general life wisdom and then one for real estate.
Yeah, I'm a big reader. I mean, see, my library is part of it in the background here. But so I've got tons and tons of books. Probably my favorite all-time sales book is called Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play by a guy named Mahan Khalsa. It's probably written 20 years ago or so, but fabulous book. Real estate specific, I'd say, I'm more listening to podcasts like this and, a lot more on the podcast side on the real estate front than books. I can't even think of a specific book in real estate that I have, but I do listen to quite a bit of, I really like Wally Walker's webcast, Driven by Insight. He's CEO and chairman of Walker Dunlop. He's an excellent host. That's probably my favorite one on real estate.
And the book you mentioned, Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play, who's the author of that one?
His name is Mahan Khalsa, Khalsa.
All right.
Interesting. I highly, highly, highly recommend that material.
Yeah, I'm going to have to pick it up. All right. Next question is for your younger self. So let's go back to the Matt who was, let's say he was back in California, just getting into the mortgage game. Go back to him, look him in the eye, give him one piece of advice moving forward.
Yeah, be a lifelong learner. I mean, learn, expose yourself to as much material as you possibly can. And that's, you know, the learning doesn't end when you get out of school, you know, and fortunately I took that advice for my own self, but I probably had 5 or 6 years that I would have had a head start on it if I'd have met myself now.
Yeah, it's crazy how much you always feel like once you get a hang of a certain skill, you feel like you know it, but there's so much more that you need to learn. And everything kind of cross-pollinates. So keep learning is great advice for your younger self. Moves us to the next question. And this is about the U.S. It's a big place. There's a lot of opportunity. Give me the single metro, the single city you're most excited about investing in today.
That's a great question. And I'd say generally we're pretty agnostic. We look more for the people than necessarily the market. But that's honestly, man, I can't pick one. So you stumped me on that one.
Fair enough. All right. Next question is about finding deals. It all starts with getting in contact with the seller and writing up that purchase agreement. In your case, I guess we would say finding GPs. So yeah. What is your favorite way to find, generate leads and find new partners?
Yeah, it's things like this, and it's largely through the advisory and coaching platform. And then our capital markets group is another thing for people might want to check out, fairwaycapitalmarkets.com. But we also provide services to help GPs raise capital for their fund. So it's a combination of helping them set the fund up, helping them market and promote that fund through capital markets, and ultimately potentially investing in alongside it. So really the entire platform is designed to provide services to, guys like I was 20 years ago that are, trying to scale their business. And then we just help them grow, help them in multiple ways. And then we invest in alongside them. So that's our strategy.
Perfect. All right. Next question is about lessons learned. Not every deal goes the way that we expect it. But in those deals is where you learned your biggest lessons and you could take them on to the next deal. So what was a deal that went a little sideways for you? And then what was the lesson you pulled from it?
Yeah, I think some of the stuff right now that we did in 20 and 21 on these hotel conversions are probably the most challenged stuff that we've really ever had to deal with, because, between variable rate debt, that even if you get rate locks for a period of time with the capital markets meltdown, those locks expire, right? So, when you're doing value add stuff, getting fixed rate debt's impossible. So you have to really be careful about the debt. And then the scope of work is also challenging. So you've got to build in huge contingencies for things that you just can't control, right? Municipalities not giving you permits or changing their tune in the middle of whatever it is that they're doing. So, and ultimately the operating agreements that you negotiate with your partners, right? You need to make sure that those are tight so that you have some element of control that if you need to step in and do something that you can do it. So, always lots of lessons learned on deals. And you look back, but of course, the benefit of hindsight is 2020. As we all know, but the longer you do this, it's like you never stop learning. So, And then on the fund side, coming out of the Great Recession, we had to wind down a fund where we had a large credit facility that wouldn't renew. So, a lot of it has to do with debt and how you use debt and how you manage debt that can get you. I mean, when it's going good, that's great. When it's not going so good, that's not as great.
Yeah, all lessons learned that probably wouldn't have learned if you hadn't gone through it. So I'm sure you keep those in your pocket and you bring them on to the next deals.
That's exactly right.
All right. So that leads us to the very last question. This is for the listeners. I'm sure people want to reach out, get in contact with you. Where can they find you? And then what can they expect when they reach out?
Yeah, I think if they can find me on, you can find me online. LinkedIn's probably the best place. It's Matthew Burke, Fairway America. You can certainly email me anytime, matt.burke@fairwayamerica.com. And I think LinkedIn's, like I say, the best spot. But between Verivest, Capital Markets, and Fairway America, there's plenty of ways to find me, online.
Cool. I'll put those links in the show notes. So if y'all want to reach out, just click a little more in the description. It'll pull down that full description. And there you can find Matt's links. All right, man. That wraps it up. Thank you very much for hopping on the show.
My pleasure, man. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. For everybody who's here with us today, thank you guys for showing up. You are the reason we do this. So if you guys have any questions, reach out to me, Gabe at realestateinvestingclub.com. If you want to support the show, just give us a like, subscribe, share, all that jazz. Other than that, I hope you guys have a great week. Keep rocking real estate, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.
All right, before I officially sign off, I have a quick announcement to make. If you're interested in becoming a passive investor in one of my deals, my own company, Kaizen Properties, is looking for capital partners for our upcoming projects. We invest in what are known as recession-resistant assets, mainly self-storage facilities, mobile home and RV parks, and industrial properties. If you're interested in investing and would like to learn a little bit more about my company, our investing criteria, and some of the previous projects we've done, go to the Real Estate Investing Club podcast at therealestateinvestingclub.com and scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page. Click on the Invest With Us button. That'll pop up the investor form. Fill that out and we will reach back out to you as soon as we can. Or if you prefer a little bit more of a personal touch, you can reach out to me at gabe@therealestateinvestingclub.com. So really, that is it. Again, it was a pleasure hanging out with you guys during this episode, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.